I now call this remote meeting of the House Climate and Energy Finance and Policy Committee to order. Good morning, everyone, and if we could take the roll.
Chair Long.
Present.
Vice Chair Akam.
Present.
Minority Lead Swazinski.
Present.
Representative Bierman.
Present.
Representative Bowe.
Present.
Representative Christensen.
Present.
Representative Franson. Let her connect to audio here really quickly. She's just joining us now. Representative Franson. Representative Grunheim.
Present. Present.
Representative Grunhagen. Representative Hollins. Representative Hornstein.
Present.
Representative Igo.
Present.
Representative Lee.
Lee, present.
Representative Lippert.
Present.
Representative Lislegard.
Present.
Representative Meckland.
Present.
Representative Munson. Representative Munson. Representative Stevenson.
Here.
A quorum is present. We have minutes from January 26, 2021. Representative Akam, have you had a chance to look over the minutes?
I have, Mr. Chair, and I move approval.
Representative Akam moves approval of the minutes from January 26. Any discussion? All those in favor say aye. Aye.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
Aye.
The minutes are adopted. So today we are going to be having an informational hearing on the topic of securitization. We've heard in this committee about the rapid pace of change of our energy transition. Coal is no longer economic and our utilities are moving towards cheaper forms of energy. And that means we're facing a stranded asset challenge. Other states have used this tool to help reduce costs for ratepayers. And the tool securitization can be thought of like refinancing the debt on a home, only in this case it would be a retired plant. In Minnesota, this could benefit all customers from our mines and large industrial users to residential customers. And today's hearing will be informational on what the concept of securitization is and then also on a draft bill that has been posted. And I think we're really fortunate to have some experts in what can be a pretty technical and weedy subject to try to help bring some understanding to the committee about this topic. And first presenter this morning, we're going to hear from five presenters, then we'll take questions for our presenters, and then we'll turn to public testimony. And our first presenter is Harriet Moyer. Ms. Moyer, please unmute yourself, introduce yourself for the record, and begin.
Thank you, Chairman Long. Good morning, everyone. My name is Harriet Moyer Aptekar, and I'm part of a national team working on financing strategies for the energy transition that's happening across the country. We piloted our work in securitization in Colorado, and we are assisting other states like Minnesota that are interested in securitization. So securitization, which you've been hearing about, I understand, is a financing tool that can be used to help with financing any capital intensive or extraordinary utility expense. Let me actually share my screen and we can take a look at the growing interest in this tool. Great. So, wait. Why is there interest in securitization? Reducing ratepayer bills is the real reason that securitization is so useful. So as we contemplate these changes in the economy, this is one tool that can be very useful to have available to assist ratepayers. Utilities normally finance capital projects like power plants with a combination of corporate debt and utility capital. The rate of interest paid on this money is called the weighted average cost of capital, And that's a combination of the two interest rates that the utility is paying on the money that it's using. In our Colorado example, Xcel Energy earns approximately 7.6% interest on every dollar invested. Securitization replaces this higher cost of utility capital with low-cost debt from AAA-rated bonds with interest rates of 3% or less. Securitization is a financing tool used originally in the 1990s when some states were deregulating utilities, stranding generation assets. Securitization, also known as ratepayer-backed bonds, has been used for a variety of utility costs. Examples include pollution controls being added to plants, storm recovery costs, and the recovery of capital costs for the early retirement of a damaged nuclear reactor plant in Florida. In this Florida Duke Energy example, which you see on the screen, $1.3 billion of bonds at a 2.72% interest rate were issued to refund the utility capital, which was at a much higher rate of interest. This transaction means ratepayers will realize $680 million in savings over the life of the bonds. Special state legislation is required to create these bonds and allow ratepayers to realize these savings. Properly created ratepayer-backed bonds achieve a AAA rating from bond rating agencies, which means the bonds will have a lower interest rate than the utility's cost of capital, approximately 3% versus the 7.6% in our Colorado example, and using this low-cost money to pay off the undepreciated balance when a coal-fired power plant retires early saves ratepayers money. So how do we gain access to ratepayer-backed bonds? As I said, the bonds can only be made available by state legislation, and this legislation creates a new property right, which can be pledged to repay the bonds. This property right is a non-bypassable charge on ratepayer bills that the state guarantees will be collected until the bonds are repaid. The legislation must also include several key clauses that create protections for investors. With these state guarantees in place, the ratepayer-backed bonds will be considered low risk by the bond rating agencies, earning a AAA rating and achieving the lowest possible interest rate. The legislation also creates the critical oversight role for the commission in approving the financing order and protecting ratepayer interests. Defining the uses for the bonds is also a key provision in the legislation because the bonds can only be issued for purposes defined in statute. Wall Street investors are agnostic about bond uses, and as long as the bonds achieve a AAA rating, there's strong market interest in purchasing the bonds. The financial assurances required to achieve the AAA rating mean the bills are complicated and lengthy. Allowing ample time to review the bill and answer questions is important. Critical balances must be maintained to protect the ratepayer interests by maintaining commission oversight, and in the case of plant retirement, allowing the utility a fair, transparent path to reinvestment. The legislation can face many challenges, and this is a list of key stakeholders we need to get on board if securitization legislation is to succeed. I suspect many of these stakeholders are already participants in the hearings your committee's been having about securitization. Our team's work has triggered new interest in securitization nationally. The original 2017 Colorado bill became a model for the bill that passed Montana in 2019. It's also the model for pending legislation in Missouri, Kansas, and Iowa. The Colorado and New Mexico bills, which passed in 2019, were not as directly patterned on the original model bill, but they were part of larger climate omnibus bills and made the tool available in those states. Missouri, Kansas, Indiana, and possibly Minnesota plan to introduce securitization bills in 2021. Wisconsin, North Carolina, and Texas have securitization statutes on the books and are considering amending that existing statute to add plant retirements and transition assistance to the permitted uses for the bonds. The National Association of Regulatory Utility Commissioners, or NARUC, has been providing commissioner training sessions dedicated to explaining securitization and the important role commissions play in issuing the financing order to create and supervise the bonds. Currently, there's tremendous interest in using ratepayer bonds, particularly to deal with the extraordinary costs utilities are facing because of climate change. This is the list of bond issues planned for 2021. Tragically, you can see wildfire costs in California and hurricane damage costs in North Carolina are the largest pending bond issues. The 2019 New Mexico statute is being used in 2021 for the early retirement of the San Juan Generating Station and to provide transition assistance to affected communities and workers. You have representatives from both Wisconsin and Michigan here today to talk about their 2021 pending bond issues and their broader experience using securitization in those states. In conclusion, I'd like to note that Representative Long's draft bill includes the key points required in state legislation to make securitization available in Minnesota. It's a promising bill that could provide savings for Minnesota ratepayers. It's great to be with you today to talk about securitization. Thank you.
Thank you so much for joining us, Ms. Moyer. We will go to our other testifiers, and then we'll come back to questions for all of our presenters. Next, we're going to hear from Thor Underdahl with Minnesota Power. Mr. Underdahl, please introduce yourself and begin.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. So happy to be here with you today. I'm working to share my slides and hopefully thumbs up that we can see them. All right, wonderful. Well, really appreciate being here with you. Miss seeing you all in person and look forward to the doing so when the opportunity allows. Minnesota Power has been talking about and working with a variety of stakeholders on securitization as a topic for quite some time. We, like our other utilities, are working through a transition in the energy sector, as everyone's aware of. So we certainly want to understand and vet and analyze all of the possible opportunities or tools that could be potentially useful during this energy transition. We shared with many of you that are part of the Legislative Energy Commission some of this work last November regarding our collaboration with the Rocky Mountain Institute on analyzing this specific case for us. And we also have a unique order point from the Public Utilities Commission to bring some of this analysis forward. And we'll be doing so in our second phase of that report here shortly on the heels of our very transformational integrated resource plan, which was just filed yesterday. Thousands and thousands of pages of light reading if any of you are bored at night. But very exciting and a very transformational time at Minnesota Power. Before I get to the kind of the heart of the matter, I just wanted to maybe for a foundational sake, just highlight Minnesota Power. And the uniqueness that I'll share is not just to give everyone, hey, this is who Minnesota Power is. It's relative to the topic of securitization as well too. So many of you know us well, but some are new to the committee. But Minnesota Power is an investor-owned utility. We serve northeastern Minnesota, about 26,000 square miles. The uniqueness that comes from Minnesota Power is that amongst investor-owned utilities, we're very small. We only have about 145,000 residential customers. That's kind of like a big co-op. And we have a predominantly industrial-based customer makeup. So around 65-75% on a given year is industrial sales to large taconite mines, paper mills and forestry products, very energy intensive and trade exposed customers. And the reason that I mentioned that is that that's directly relative to securitization. So one of the things that we've worked through as we've collaborated with Rocky Mountain Institute is understanding the unique challenges that are posed by being a smaller utility and also having a more revenue, a more volatile revenue base. So this pandemic is a good example. We saw 40% of our sales go away for an extended period when we had indefinite idlings of a few facilities. Luckily, one KeyTac is back, but we also saw similar volatility in 2015 and 16 and 2009 and 2010. So always important that with the tool, we understand that it's going to affect different utilities differently. As an example, I know we'll hear later today from Wisconsin and Michigan, two specific cases I know well. As those particular utilities, WEC, Wisconsin Energy Group, is about five times bigger than Minnesota Power with a pretty standard residential customer base, and Consumers Energy is about seven times bigger than us. So we're proud of everything that we do, but we kind of live in our own space as far as our customer makeup and the size of utility that we are, and that uniquely affects how securitization can kind of meet that sweet spot. So what are we doing and why are we considering securitization? Just as some quick background, when I started with the company about 14 years ago, we were 95% coal-based utility. So we've made a drastic transition, and we're very proud to say that we're the first utility in Minnesota as of the end of 2020 to reach 50% renewable energy, which I think is a pretty astounding feat, meeting standards for the state decades early, and most recently committing to our next phase of Energy Forward, which commits us to 100% carbon-free energy and a coal-free system by 2035. So some details of that and what we laid out, and now that we have more details to share, is we're looking towards immediate carbon reductions with the economic dispatch transition for our Unit 3 plant. So that means we'll start running that via economic dispatch. We'll retire that unit in 2030. So about 5 years early compared to its depreciated life. And we would look to transition and analyze opportunities at our Unit 4 facility in Cohasset, Minnesota, for other possibly refueling, remission opportunities, but again, committing to that low carbon, 100% carbon-free future. Boswell Energy Center is really unique, and I think that's the other thing that is important to this. Financing is one part of this tool, but this is also a technical challenge. My engineers at our company, we went through 7 of 9 coal retirements, and those were very difficult and hard and had technical challenges, but I think they refer to Unit 3 and 4 as the load-bearing walls. If you're doing back to the housing refinancing equation, the load-bearing walls, and that this is the last spinning inertia of major utility generating asset between Monticello and Manitoba. So it performs a critical function in what it does for the system and the support for the system. And so we're doing a lot of analysis in our IRP, and you'll see that as we have that discussion over the next 18 months on how vital this is, just as a voltage support frequency and helping to ensure reliability for our iron range load. So that also makes this an important part of that discussion. We shared some of this in November. That's some initial items that we saw as we analyzed securitization, is that there is some potential to potentially lower costs as it's been shared. I wish it was as simple as refinancing my house loan, because I've done that before, and that was a quick stop by the bank, and this is a little more complicated than that, but there is some opportunity there if all the boxes are able to be checked. And as was mentioned by the previous testifier, you balance out a whole wide variety of interested. There's lots of people that are involved in this and have a stake in this, so that's super important. And we also have to take into account, though, the unique aspects, as I said, of Minnesota Power. The important part, in the words I want everyone to understand, is that it's a non-bypassable ratepayer-backed bond. So once you put it into place, it exists, and then there are formulaic true-up adjustments. So if you have a very volatile revenue base, say some of your customers go away, you then have to reformulate and basically up the surcharge to other customers. So you always want to make sure you're really doing that stress testing to understand what that might mean in more downside scenarios, you know, or in good scenarios. So that's just an important part of this. That means that especially for a utility like us with a lot of revenue volatility, also because of our size, that really means that the size and tenor of bonds are important. And as I mentioned, once you kind of lock it in, there's less flexibility for commissions present and future than to make changes to those, because that's the whole thing that gets you that low interest rate, is that once you set it, you can't touch it. It has to be what it is. So you want to make sure that you go in kind of eyes wide open. And then from a utility perspective, obviously, you know, we want to make sure that this still balances what we want, what we need to do, which is bring low cost capital to our investments and our future portfolio. So making sure that you balance the utility financial health as well, too, is a key aspect of it. And I also just wanted to hit real quick that there are other rate mitigation tools. We actually put a pretty expansive package in front of the Public Utilities Commission in August around competitiveness and different levers that we're hoping to help pull over the coming decade to help mitigate what we understand are increasing, you know, certain increasing costs during this transition. So we want to make sure that as we consider securitization, we understand that it is a tool in the toolbox. It might be the right tool in the toolbox, but it's not the only tool. And we consider it alongside those other tools, given its complexity and all of the different stakeholder needs. Just because this is a really important part of the bill and it's very near and dear to my heart, I wanted to highlight for folks the transition that Minnesota Power has went through over the last decade. As I mentioned, we're proud of our success to move to 50% renewable and 50% carbon reduction, but it has meant a loss in headcount, particularly in our generation operations and our thermal operations. And that is an important part of the bill, and it's a central tenet to Minnesota Power that as we've worked through this transition, we've done so in a way that allows for as much support and a just transition for our workforce and for our communities. And that really is a pillar of what we put forward in our preferred IRP plan. I was actually in human resources for 5 years at Minnesota Power before I somehow became a lobbyist. It was the most challenging and probably the most indelible mark that was put on me was when we had to go and speak with our plant employees upon impending retirement to try to figure out what was next for them. So it's something that we hold dear, and I want people to understand that, you know, with securitization or without securitization, it's something that I personally and our company is dedicated to getting right over the course of the next 10 to 15 years. And I was very heartened recently by the Biden administration, which one of its executive orders was around creating an interagency working group on coal and power plant communities and economic revitalization. So I hope to work with this committee and others to find out ways that local, state, and federal governments, through securitization or otherwise, can work to support our communities and our workers as we look towards a just transition. The good thing that we have with this is we're all urgently working to try to get this clean energy transition, you know, expeditiously underway, but time is the thing that helps us hit those doubles and triples in economic development. It allows us to retrain, work through attrition as much as possible and natural retirement, and work with all of those entities I previously mentioned to try to put as many funding and policy mechanisms in place to help support this transition. So with our current plan in front of the commission, we feel like that is a core tenet of why we outlined the timing the way we did, to support customers, to support communities, and make sure that it's done right as we make this energy transition. And so more forthcoming on our phase two analysis, we're still finalizing that and hope to have that in the very near future. But some quick key elements, and we look forward to working with the committee on Chair Long's draft and future conversations on securitization. What we do see is that sometimes I think it gets caught as maybe this is a tool that fits for everyone. And it sounds really good because it just sounds like a coupon. And there's a bit more to it than that. It's a bit more complicated than that. I just want to leave the committee with that. But having said that, I think that in our initial analysis, we've seen that there is some potential for NPV benefits. The unique challenges with Minnesota Power is really around our customer rate volatility. There are potential that new tools would have to be created to help adjust for this. Things like market indexing, our unique tax and debt consideration around make-whole payments, our tax appetite to truly move forward on ITCs and PTCs, all of that are the details, the boxes that I mentioned that need to be checked for each unique scenario. And then again, securitization, as with any tool, needs to be compared against the other tools in the toolbox and considered in conjunction with them to decide what's right given the unique scenario that is facing these utilities, us included. And so we look forward to filing that very soon and certainly can share that with the committee. Happy to answer any questions later that the committee may have. We're very excited about the stakeholder process in front of the commission kicking off here very shortly, so that we can get to discussing further how we can move forward on our next tranche of our energy vision and do so in a way that provides for a just transition for our communities, our workforce, and the environment. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Underdahl. And yes, I think that would be terrific if you could share the final report that you submit to the Public Utilities Commission. We can circulate that to the committee members.
Happy to
as well.
Do so.
So now we're going to hear from three speakers from across the Midwest who are talking about securitization efforts that have taken place in their states. And we're going to begin. We're fortunate to have the Chief Operating Officer of the Michigan Public Service Commission with us today, Michael Byrne. And Mr. Byrne, if you could unmute yourself and introduce yourself for the record and begin.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Mike Byrne. I am the Chief Operating Officer for the Michigan Public Service Commission. The commission is a state agency in Michigan charged with regulating electric and natural gas utilities, and which also has oversight of certain providers of telecommunications service. I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today, and I just want to talk a little bit about Michigan's experience with securitization of electric utility assets. Michigan's securitization statute, Public Act 142 of 2000, was enacted as part of a package of bills restructuring the retail electric market in the state, in which electric customers were allowed to select an unregulated third-party provider of electric generation service. Michigan's incumbent electric utilities also own generating assets and argued that the move to electric choice would result in stranded costs related to their own electric generating facilities. Securitization was identified as a mechanism to allow utilities to recoup the unrecovered book value of stranded assets. At the time, it was primarily costs associated with nuclear generating facilities, at a lower cost to ratepayers than under traditional rate-making methods. And so in order to securitize utility assets under the Michigan law, the utility has to demonstrate that the net present value of the revenues to be collected pursuant to a securitization financing order will be less than the amount that would have been recovered over the remaining life of the qualified costs using conventional financing methods. They also have to prove that securitization provides tangible and quantifiable benefits to customers of the utility, and that the expected structuring and pricing of the securitization bonds would result in the lowest securitization charges consistent with market conditions and terms of the financing order. And upon approval of the commission, costs eligible to be securitized are packaged into bonds, the proceeds of which are used to retire utility debt and equity. And a surcharge, which is trued up annually, is implemented on customer bills over a period not to exceed 15 years to pay off the bonds. Under Michigan statute, a financing order issued by the commission is irrevocable. Rehearing of the decision to adopt the order, and then appeals are limited. And the state pledges not to take any action that would impair the value of securitization property or securitization charges approved under the financing order. These provisions lower the risk of securitization bonds, which results in lower financing costs and ultimately lower rates for customers. So back in 2000, Consumers Energy and DTE Electric Company, which are the state's two largest electric utilities, securitized a combined $2.2 billion in costs at a significant savings to ratepayers. And so we've had that law on the books for a number of years. And it wasn't used for a while, but securitization next began to be used in Michigan relative to the unrecovered book value of retiring coal-fired power plants. Michigan, like many states in the Midwest, is home to several thousand megawatts of coal-fired generation. Both consumers and DTE have set out climate goals of net zero carbon emissions by 2040 and 2050, respectively. And as we continue to move towards cleaner and more economic sources of electric generation, older coal-fired plants are being retired earlier than expected. So under traditional rate making, utility assets are depreciated over the expected lifetime of those assets. And when the depreciation timeframe doesn't match up with the useful life of the asset, customers may end up paying rates which are set to recover costs for plants that are no longer in service. Securitization offers a middle ground in which the utility is able to recover the remaining costs of the asset, but at a lower cost of capital than otherwise would have occurred under traditional rate making. So in 2013, Consumers Energy sought and received authorization to securitize about $390 million in unrecovered book value for their Classic 7 coal units, which were retiring in 2016. An additional round of securitization was authorized by the Commission for Consumers Energy at the end of 2020 in the amount of up to $677 million in unrecovered book value for the Karn 1 and 2 coal plants to be retired in 2023. And we also expect DTE Electric Company to file a securitization case in 2021 for unrecovered book value of a retiring unit at the River Rouge coal plant. So in the cases in which securitization has been authorized in Michigan, the difference between the remaining book value of assets under traditional rate-making methods versus the cost of securitization has been hundreds of millions of dollars, and that's to the benefit of ratepayers. So at a time when there is considerable push to retire coal plants earlier than their expected useful lives, securitization has emerged as an effective tool to assist utilities in recovering costs for undepreciated plant investments while benefiting ratepayers through lower costs than they otherwise would have been likely to pay. I want to thank you for the opportunity to speak with all of you today, and I would be happy to take any questions when the time is appropriate. Thanks.
Thank you so much for joining us, Mr. Byrne. Next, we are going to hear from our neighbor to the east, Tom Content, who's the Executive Director of the Wisconsin Citizen Utilities Board. Mr. Content, please unmute yourself, introduce yourself, and begin.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for inviting me, Chairman Long, members of the committee. My name is Tom Content. I am Executive Director of the Citizens Utility Board in Wisconsin, and I'm here to discuss Wisconsin's recent experience with securitization under its environmental trust financing law. So CUB is Wisconsin's only advocate for residential and small business customers of the electric, natural gas, and water utilities. We advocate at the Public Service Commission and are focused on safe, reliable, affordable service, fair prices for customers, and we work to advance policies that emphasize affordability in the clean energy transition. So a core principle for CUB is ensuring that utility customers don't have to pay twice as utilities execute on their decarbonization strategies. Our biggest fear is that utilities will not only profit from the new cleaner generation that they say is needed for the transition, but will continue to profit from coal plants long after they've shut down and are no longer needed to keep the lights on. Wisconsin has had a form of securitization on the books since 2004, when Act 152 was enacted. The goal of the legislation was to ensure at the time that utility shareholders didn't see returns from installation of pollution control equipment that was required to be added to settle violations of the Clean Air Act. And there was a concern about the ratepayer impact of all the investments needed to keep older coal plants running at a time when Wisconsin was also building new coal plants. The statute enables securitization to be used if a utility so chooses, but did not place a requirement that any utility had to pursue ETF. So for 15 years, not one utility opted to use environmental trust financing while they installed pollution controls at multiple plants. More recently, last year, we saw the first use of our securitization law for a power plant that was already shut down. The Pleasant Prairie Power Plant, south of Milwaukee, near the Illinois border, was a 1,200 megawatt coal plant owned by Wisconsin Electric Power, part of WEC Energy Group. The plant was shut down in 2018. So as the consumer advocate and concerned about the energy price competitiveness for residential and small business customers, CUB decided to make the coal plant retirement costs a key issue in the rate case that was in front of the PSC in 2019. In that case, CUB and other interveners reached a settlement with the utility under which the utility committed to securitizing the remaining costs on the books for the pollution controls that had been added at that plant in the 2005 to 2010 timeframe. So the commitment to finally use the ETF law was part of a comprehensive rate settlement, and that was approved in December 2019 by the Public Service Commission. WEPCO then filed a securitization case in 2020 that was decided just a few months ago. So as we sit today, we're in the kind of in the process of waiting for the bonds to be issued. The bottom line that we expect for WEPCO ratepayers is that they will see nearly $89 million in savings over the next 15 or so years. And that's from refinancing the remaining $100 million in pollution control costs that were still on the books when the plant shut down. Those actual numbers are still to be determined, but we expect that the bonds to be issued, as you were similar to what you were hearing earlier, those would attract an interest rate in the range of or below 3.25%. And that's less than half of the 77.5% weighted average cost of capital for this utility. Of course, had a more comprehensive form of securitization been available, even bigger savings would have been in store for customers. Pollution control costs are just one portion of the total costs still to be depreciated when a plant shuts down. So we're hopeful that, similar to what you're contemplating in Minnesota, policymakers in Wisconsin will have more tools added to our toolbox beyond our environmental trust financing law to help ensure rates are affordable through the transition that's well underway. Utilities in Wisconsin continue to announce coal plant retirements. In fact, another big one, a plant co-owned by three of our major utilities, was announced just this morning. For CUB, ensuring customers save on power plants no longer needed to keep the lights on is a critical component to enabling the most affordable clean energy transition possible. Thanks again for inviting me, and I'd be happy to answer questions later on. Thanks.
Thank you so much, Mr. Content. I appreciate you being with us. Our final speaker before we go to member questions comes to us from the state of Kansas, and it is Ashok Gupta, who's an energy economist with the Natural Resources Defense Council. Mr. Gupta, please introduce yourself for the record and begin.
Thank you, Chairman Long. It's good to be here with the committee and everybody else. My name is Ashok Gupta. I'm a senior energy economist with NRDC, Natural Resources Defense Council, based here in Kansas City. I've been with NRDC 30 years now. I was in the New York office for most of that time, 20-some years, and moved here in 2012, and have been focusing on energy policy issues in Missouri and Kansas in particular in the last few years, and this is where my experience on securitization, which is what I want to talk to you about today. I first became familiar with securitization actually in a similar context as to what happened in Michigan, which is when New York State was going through the process of restructuring and had to deal with the plants that had higher book value than market value, and that regulatory asset stranded cost had to be dealt with to deliver savings to consumers. And I think it was one of the first and earliest uses of securitization in the country. And this product was developed in a way to help, quote, manage a transition. So the idea here is one of, if you have costs and you're making a transition, and you're making a transition in this case because you have less expensive resources available to you, and you have more expensive resources that are being retired in order to access those lower cost resources. So if we didn't have this economic reason to transition, it would not necessarily be a tool you'd want to use. I mean, clearly there are storm cost recovery issues, and there are issues related to what you just heard, pollution control equipment. But at the heart of this is utilities make long-term investments that later, when you look at them, are like, well, there are other alternatives available to us. Back when we did this 20-some years ago in New York, it was because of combined cycle gas plants. Especially large customers were saying there are cheaper resources out there, and we are stuck paying for existing resources. How can we accelerate this transition? At that point, deregulation became part of the conversation. But now I think of this transition as, how do you actually get the benefits of a transition from higher cost resources to lower cost resources without deregulation, getting the benefits without the full restructuring and having to sell your generation resources, and which is what we did 20-some years ago in many parts of the country. So it's a tool, it's a cost benefit tool, and even as an environmentalist, selling this and talking about this tool in Missouri and Kansas and working with our utilities and working with the large customers, first and foremost, you have to think about this as, how do we transition in order to lower costs? And that's what this tool, I think, allows you to do, because it allows you to access low-cost financing, and that's a mechanism. And most of the legislation details are about making yourself, you know, comply with what the bond markets really are looking for. And you heard a lot of that earlier in terms of what's needed in legislation. The key in terms of the energy policy decisions and how this tool will be used and how it will be implemented is, of course, very, very important. And the question there is going to be, what are those questions that go beyond the structuring of securitization and what's needed, which I think is not going to be the controversial part, but how you use this tool and what you want to put in legislation and what you want to leave to your regulatory commission. That's going to be the heart of the conversation in terms of those questions about, for instance, you know, what the utility can and will be allowed to reinvest in, because when you take things out of the rate base, you want to be able to add things into the rate base as a utility, and how that decision around what you add and how you still create real benefits for consumers. And there are lots of important tax issues to be dealt with if you're dealing with wind PTC or solar ITC or other tax policies, and how that plays into the savings for consumers. So there's the securitization part that deals with the retired assets, and then there's the reinvestment part in new assets. And you need to look at all of that when you're calculating the benefits to consumers. All the analysis we've done for both Missouri and Kansas, and what you're going to be seeing, I think, in Minnesota from the RMI analysis, you know, has to kind of show the real benefit to consumers that's material and significant. But securitization and how to access low-cost financing to deal with your retired assets is one important part, but the recycling of the capital and investing in new resources and then looking at the total equation of what the benefits are is what you've hear, you know, you've been hearing from Michigan and Wisconsin in terms of that's the implementation phase. And in legislation, you want to make sure that what you're saying is, unless there are real material net present value benefits, this is not a tool that's going to be used and implemented on the on by either the utility or by the regulators in terms of moving forward. I'm going to leave a lot of time here for questions, because I think there'll be, I'm sure, a lot of good questions here. It's a complicated topic. In Missouri and Kansas, we've been working on this for a couple of years, and there's a new draft that's going to be coming out and being introduced in both Missouri and Kansas in the next week. And we've tried to have a very open process where key stakeholders are engaged. Because if this is a type of bill that gets controversial and complicated and people start opposing it, it's very unlikely to pass. So a lot of the work in getting this done and across the finish line happens through the stakeholder process and the conversations that need to happen. Because otherwise, as you can imagine, any bill that's 20, 30 pages is going to be complicated to pass any legislature. So we've been very involved with this in Missouri and Kansas, and happy to pass along any of our experiences in terms of the conversations that have taken place and where we are in the process. And fingers crossed, we can get it passed in both states in the next couple of months.
Thank you so much, Mr. Gupta. So we'll now turn to member questions. I'll begin. I have two questions, and then we'll go to other members. And the first is, Mr. Gupta, you mentioned that large customers in particular have been very interested in this tool, which makes sense considering that they're large energy users. And I'm wondering if you could speak to what the interest is for large customers and you know, what type of support you've seen in other states from large customers for this solution.
Yes. So in both Kansas and in Missouri, when we've had hearings last year in Kansas and the previous year in Missouri, the large industrial customers did come out and testify in favor of the bill. And I think it's basically they understand how change is happening. Coal plant retirements are on the table. There have even been coal plants retired from which costs are still being recovered, and how this tool can help lower costs for those customers. And they've experienced that in other states. I mean, they've seen securitization used. A lot of these large customers operate in many states. So when they've seen this operating in other states and seen real benefits, that's what's driving their support for securitization. I think the details in terms of course, what the utility will invest in and the IRP process to determine what the replacement will be and if what the demand growth will be, what the, you know, all those questions are very, very important. And so there is support for the using the tool. They know the details will have to be dealt with when the financing order is being considered by the commission, where all the further details will be looked at, because that's not going to be in legislation. So the legislation authorizes and creates the ability to use this tool and sets the parameters for what can, you know, what, as Harriet said, the securitization tool can be used for. But so I think going in, the industrial see an opportunity here to both have it, manage the transition, and see lower cost as part of that process.
Thank you. So my second question is for Ms. Moyer. I think we heard that for the states that have these laws, it's been voluntary, and utilities have come forward and made use of these tools in specific circumstances. For the Colorado and New Mexico examples you cited, I'm interested in how those states have set up these tools to be used to help with workers and with the communities that are being impacted to help support the transition, and what that's looked like in those states.
Certainly, Mr. Chairman. In the Colorado and New Mexico bills are very different from one another. The Colorado bill ended up going through quite a legislative sausage-making process, quite honestly, to realize the passage of the legislation. And as a result, transition assistance for the workers and the affected communities have some very specific language that was provided by labor in terms of retraining for union members. And it actually also applies to transportation workers, plant workers, and if we have coal mines in Colorado that are adversely impacted by a plant closing. So that language is very clearly drawn. There is some specific language that was negotiated to assist communities where plants close that have outstanding certificates of participation that are tied to the plant tax base. So there's some very detailed language in the bill related to that. But more broadly, the commission is empowered to consider transition assistance in the course of each financing order, so that the commission can hear testimony from communities and workers that are impacted by, potentially impacted by a closure, and make the decision about if there are any additional supports that should be provided. So we have some detailed requirements, and then we also have a broader option. In New Mexico, that bill was written with very specific predefined amounts that were negotiated with the various interest groups that were going to have adverse impacts. So there are specific dollar amounts allocated for worker retraining, and an actual dollar amount is noted in the legislation, specific amounts for the tribal transition costs with specific dollar amounts attached, and not an opportunity for the commission to consider any kind of broader requests. The transition support for the communities has some money specifically tied to it. Once again, a defined dollar amount in statute. There's also a direction that new generation should be constructed in the area where the plant is retired to help restore some of that tax base, that's to be given priority treatment by the commission. I should also mention that the New Mexico bill is unusual among the securitization bills we're talking about, because it was very specifically drafted to tie to the retirement of the San Juan Generating Station. So there's not a lot of latitude using it for other plants. There's some opportunity for that, but the intent was really for this bill to address the San Juan Generating Station.
Thank you. Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you to all the presenters, and good education on this issue. Enjoyed hearing about it. I just had a couple questions for maybe Ms. Moyer or Mr. Gupta. This seems like an issue that has, you know, started out a couple decades ago, and all of a sudden there's a lot more interest, of course, with the changes in the industry right now. And my question, I guess, is since it would be a bill or the terms would be set and guaranteed by the state, I'm just curious in history so far if there have been any significant costs to the state where these deals haven't worked out as planned, or if what we could expect as far as cost to the state as the backstop or the guarantor of this type of a framework.
Ms. Moyer.
Sorry. I'm not sure about the order of the committee. I apologize. That's an excellent question. And I should clarify, it was mentioned on the slide, but I didn't actually say it. The state is not responsible for these ratepayer back bonds. What the state's responsibility is to establish the property right that I talked about, that non-bypassable charge that also Mr. Underhall talked about, which will stay on the ratepayer bills until the bonds are paid off. So because of that piece of information being in statute and the state's agreement not to do anything in the during the tenor of the bonds that would alter that repayment, that is the guarantee that the rating agencies look to and investors look to in terms of making the decision about rating the bonds and then purchasing the bonds. So there is no guarantee from the state or a county or a municipality that's involved in the bonds that they're guaranteeing repayment. So in the history of the bonds, states have not been held responsible for the repayment of any of these bond issues. The other experience that has happened is in one instance in the history of these bonds, a utility that had issued the bonds did go bankrupt, and that bankruptcy made no impact on the repayment of the bonds. The non-bypassable charge is actually held, and this is created in the statute, in a part of the technical language, is a bankruptcy remote entity from the utility that is paying back the bonds is actually the recipient of the charge on ratepayer bills. So in the example where the utility did go bankrupt, another utility came in to pick up that service territory. Customers paid their bills as usual. Service was not disrupted to the customers, and that charge on the bills was still collected. So that is another piece of very reassuring information from Wall Street's point of view, that the structure in legislation does, in truth, protect investors.
Mr. Gupta, did you want to add anything?
No, I think Harriet did a great job. I think the short answer is that there is no risk to the state, and that's the way it's structured, and that is essential and important, I know, to every legislator, that we're not looking to have this be backed by the state or any governmental entity. The government lays out the rules under which these bonds can be issued, and the commissions then create an order and the structure for the payment of those bonds, as Harriet just outlined, and with lots of provisions in there for making sure and creating that certainty in order to get the highest credit rating and the lowest interest rate. And especially these days with the interest rates being as low as they are, it's just a really important time to capture some of these savings for customers when you're comparing the cost of capital of the utilities versus the very low interest rates you can get for these bonds, because they are described in terms of lowering the risk to bondholders. So no risk to the state, very important question, because it comes up a lot and we don't want to be creating any risks here for the state in creating this financial tool as in, for commissions to use.
Representative Bierman, any follow-up?
No, those were good answers. Thank you so much.
Representative Swazinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this could either go to the last couple folks, but kind of along the lines of that non-bypassable portion of the bill. Is there any hook, let's say you're a former utility customer that you'd be, you know, forced to continue to pay, let's say you're a large operator that's maybe just going to cease operations within that jurisdiction. Are there any legacy costs that follow that person no matter where they go, or how does that portion work?
Who would like to take that? Ms. Moyer.
I'm happy to respond. The non-bypassable charge relates to customers accepting service from the utility in their territory. So if you're talking about an entity that ceased to exist or a residential customer who moves out of the service territory, they would no longer have that cost on their bills. But going back to the observation that Mr. Underdahl had made from...
Underdahl.
When a customer leaves, that portion of the repayment charge that would have been on their bill does still have to be covered. If there's not growth in the rate base, the fact that there's a true-up mechanism in the legislation means that a calculation is made that enough revenue is being collected off the existing ratepayer bills to make the payment on the bonds. So I understand Minnesota Power's concern to be they can have a large drop in rate-based participation, which means the charges to repay the bonds would be recalculated and then paid for by the remaining customers in the rate base. So that is a factor that I understand they're concerned about. But if someone leaves, they are no longer obligated to pay the charge to repay the bonds.
Representative Swazinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just want to flesh out a little bit this retraining of employees. So is this essentially when the bond is let, a certain like cash accounts created? That's what it sounds like was done in Colorado so they could potentially, you know, build solar panels or whatever, retrain these employees. What is that just kind of portioned out as far as the bond when the dollars are let and then distributed kind of through an application process for those former employees?
Ms. Moyer.
Yes, the bonds are issued, and as part of that bond issuance, the financing order that made the bonds available, whatever decision the state has made for transition assistance, those funds would be part of the bonds. So when the bonds are sold, the amount of money that's been designated in the financing order for transition assistance would then be paid into whatever agency or account or mechanism the state decided it felt was appropriate for managing that money. And whatever process is determined by the state for retraining workers would be then implemented with the money from the bonds after they're sold. So there is no specific requirement for how transition assistance is defined. It's something that we've discovered in our work recently with this tool, that the amount of savings realized when the bonds refinance already existing capital in a retired plant, that savings is enough to provide reduced costs for ratepayers and also use some of the money for transition assistance. The design of transition assistance has been unique in each of the situations that allow that use in their bill.
And I'll just speak briefly to the draft that was posted. It creates an energy worker transition account that would have a portion to be determined, you know, between the Public Utilities Commission and the utility that's requesting to use securitization of the bond issue would go into that account and to be used for paying for a worker transition, and that the capital becomes available because, as has been explained, of the difference between the rate of return for the utilities and the bond issue rate. Representative Swazinski.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And it just kind of looking at kind of what's happened in other states, is there a rough estimate on how it's been utilized, these accounts? You know, how many employees have been had access to these accounts through this process?
This is a pretty new process. I was just going to say, this is a pretty new process, and I think it's in Kansas and Missouri, it's really not even sure what the legislature would want to include in terms of transition assistance. So the first question to ask, and this transition assistance was not part of the earlier drafts of earlier bills when we were dealing with restructuring, but it's come more with this issue of, you know, early retirements and replacement issues. So it's pretty new, and it really is up to legislature and stakeholders to determine what portion of the savings might be allocated for transition assistance, because the key thing, of course, is you're creating benefits here with securitization, because if you didn't, there would be nothing else to talk about. You have all these benefits. How do you want to allocate the benefits? And consumers want rate reduction, especially large customers will say you should use all those benefits just to lower rates. There's a judgment policy call in terms of, okay, if you're not, you know, maybe we should not use all of it for lowering rates. We can keep 5 to 10% of it and use it for transition assistance, because that's also an important value and priority. So to me, this question goes back to you in terms of how you want the benefits divvied up. And their clear benefits is the important point. And if you want a higher portion of the benefits, go for transition assistance. That can be done. How it's allocated in terms of retraining versus, dealing with other issues, that is a good conversation to have. And I know Harriet probably dealt with it a lot more in terms of those conversations. But just backing up, it's not like there's no... I don't think there's a formula here in terms of, and not even, probably not enough best practice to rely on, but it is a issue of prioritization for the different states and the different stakeholders who are at the table.
And I'll just mention for the draft, we use 20% as the amount that would be going into the worker transition account, but certainly that's a draft and open to discussion. Representative Swazinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just what would be the estimate in other states, what you've seen in Colorado or Kansas or Missouri, of the, you talked about lower rates. How much lower will these rates potentially be? Let's just say you did take that 20% and put it into workers' accounts. What if you just put all of it into lower rates? What is your estimate? How much lower would people's bills be than they are today after this comes to fruition in those states? Obviously we're talking a little bit hypothetical because it's not that old. How much lower will people's rates be in those states?
I might redirect that question to our actual examples from Michigan and Wisconsin, because I think they could speak to that. Mr. Byrne, would you like to speak to the impact on rates? I don't know if he had to leave. Maybe Mr. Content, if you could speak to Wisconsin.
I'm sorry, I was distracted. Can you?
Oh, Mr. Byrne. Yeah, the question was, what's the impact on rates of the securitization reductions that you've seen in your state?
What we essentially do is pull the securitized amounts out of base rates, and they end up being a separate surcharge. So for the coal plant retirements that we've seen, that basically has the effect of lowering rates. I think that utilities are in our state are in a mode of a significant amount of investment relative to the distribution system in particular. So I think that the combination of the lower overall amounts that you see through the securitization charges and a little bit of headroom that might be there as a result, you do see an initial reduction, but they're typically, making investments to be able to kind of fill that in.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Swazinski.
Just to clarify, so it's my understanding that the savings aren't actually seen. What it does is subsidize increased transmission costs due to the renewable energy push, that'd be my guess. Is that essentially what Mr. Byrne said?
Mr. Byrne.
So all other things being equal, you would see a reduction in sort of the overall amounts that customers are paying. I think that, you know, if you just take the securitized amounts out of base rates and have the separate surcharge, because our utilities in Michigan are sort of in an investment mode right now, there are other things that they can then go and spend on. And in Michigan, we actually, our transmission system is separate. It's a separate transmission company. So our incumbent utilities don't have transmission assets, but they are making significant investments in their distribution systems currently. So that's probably where some of that replacement spending is going.
Mr. Gupta, it looked like you wanted to chime in.
Now, why don't we let Tom go first, since I think he has good examples on the ground. I was going to talk more about the modeling results that we have, so we can look at what the specific benefits of securitization. If you did $500 million of securitization and did all the other things to make all your assumptions, you have to look at the portfolio of the utility, and I think you're going to get some of that analysis for Minnesota and the RMI modeling that's been done. So the specific answer for a specific utility or state is going to be based on the modeling. The fact that there are other expenditures at the same time, that's what Mike's talking about. So you can look at the net in terms of what the total impact might be because of other things happening. But if you just isolate the securitization and look at what it does in terms of resulting in, you know, material benefits, that's what the modeling shows. And happy to share the analysis for what's been done in Missouri and Kansas around this. But Harriet, you may even have a quick answer on $100 million of securitization results in X amount of savings to consumers. But I'm going to let Tom go because I know he probably has something
to add. Let's go to Mr. Content, and then we're going to have to turn to public testimony. Mr. Content.
Sure. Well, we do have that $100 million example here because that's the exact size of our issuance. And on our monthly bills, the environmental control cost for our residential customers is about 45 cents a month, at least at the outset. This was negotiated in the context of a rate freeze settlement of a 2-year rate case. I think the actual impact on rates going forward is dependent on how successful the steel for fuel strategy is for utilities as they look to you take advantage of the low cost of solar energy as kind of a mitigator for the fuel increases we've seen in recent years on both the coal plant cost and natural gas side of things. So it's more of a bet on the future when it comes to rates.
Thank you, Mr. Kinnett. Thank you, Representative Swazinski. So we have six individuals who have signed up for public testimony. And we will first hear from Jessica Trish. Please introduce yourself and begin.
Hey, sorry, my video is not working, but can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Okay, thank you, Chair Long and committee members. Sorry you can't see my face. Zoom is telling me it cannot start video, but thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Jessica Trich. I am a senior campaign representative with the Sierra Club's Beyond Coal to Clean Energy campaign here in Minnesota. The Sierra Club represents over 80,000 Minnesotans empowered to protect our community's well-being through environmental advocacy. I'm happy to be here today speaking in support of securitization as a tool to support ratepayers, communities, and our climate in a transition away from fossil fuels to clean energy. As folks have talked about, running coal plants in Minnesota is now far more expensive than building new clean energy in our state. Based on the economics of affordable, abundant, renewable energy and calls from Minnesotans for bold action on climate, we are shifting away from coal rapidly. Securitization could give our state a new tool to lower costs for ratepayers and provide support for workers and communities facing the loss of a coal plant. As the experts have said, securitization is a tool allowing a utility to pay off its remaining debt on a coal plant so that ratepayers aren't on the hook to pay the full cost of the debt and the replacement power once that plant retires. This protects ratepayers from excessive costs and, as others have talked about, can actually lower costs for ratepayers through this transition. The retirement of a coal plant has a significant impact on the plant workers and the community as a whole. While the utility can do a lot to support this transition through worker transition plans, investing in new clean energy in the communities where the coal plant is located, and other economic development activities, we're aware that this does not fully replace the jobs, tax base, and other economic activity related to the coal plant's operation. Workers and communities will need additional support for the transition to clean energy, and securitization offers a funding stream to do so. This bill, draft bill, as you mentioned, allocates 20% of the revenue to reinvest in worker transition. We think transition assistance is an important component of any securitization legislation. Another important component of securitization legislation, which is a tongue twister, is reducing the risk of more stranded assets, like the debt from these coal plants in the future. Clean energy is cost-effective now, and economic analyses are projecting gas plants proposed today will be stranded assets in a decade. This draft bill allows reinvestment in clean energy resources, renewable energy, energy storage, energy efficiency, or load management, which helps reduce the risk of more stranded assets. So thank you, Chair Long and committee members, for the discussion on this topic. I will follow up with a report that Sierra Club released a couple years ago on securitization and other financial tools for transitioning from coal to clean energy. We look forward to working with you and other stakeholders on securitization legislation and other ways to support a just transition to clean energy. Thank you.
Thank you, and we'll be happy to circulate that to the committee if you share it with us. Next, we are hearing from Annie Levinson-Falk. Please introduce yourself and begin.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Thank you, and good morning, members. My name is Annie Levinson-Falk, and I'm the Executive Director of the Citizens Utility Board of Minnesota, or CUB, a nonprofit advocate for Minnesota energy consumers. I want to thank Chair Long for all of your work to put together this comprehensive bill. This is a difficult topic for those of us who are more used to working in energy policy than in the financial world, but it's a really important opportunity. As the committee has heard many times, coal generation has become among the most costly power that's used in Minnesota today. And thoughtfully replacing that electricity generation with something more cost effective will significantly reduce costs for customers, not to mention reducing emissions, which is why Minnesota's utilities are quickly moving to other generation sources. As long as the plants continue to operate, Minnesotans' electricity bills are higher than they need to be. But retiring a power plant, especially one that isn't yet paid off, creates its own challenges. Power plants are often the largest employers and the largest sources of property taxes in a region. And when millions of dollars still remain to be paid off on the plant, someone is going to have to cover those costs. Right now, the options for paying off the balance on a retiring plant are pretty limited. Some argue that utility shareholders should cover the costs. After all, they earn a rate of return for taking investment risks. However, when a utility followed the PUC's orders and made prudent investments in these plants, as much as I too prefer when shareholders pay rather than ratepayers, that's not always a reasonable course of action. And it's also very, very rarely chosen by utility regulators. I suppose that the legislature could decide it's in the statewide public interest to play off a plant balance and to do so with tax dollars, but I don't need to tell this committee why that also is not a great option. So that leaves ratepayers holding the bag. Very likely, ratepayers will be responsible for covering the outstanding balance on retiring power plants, plus a built-in rate return on equity for the utility. That's a very expensive proposition for a plant that's no longer being used. Securitization gives us an additional option and one that can slash the cost of the outstanding balance on those plants while using the savings to help with the transition. A portion of those savings can help the workers at the plant that are closing. A portion can be reinvested by the utility in new capital. And importantly, from CUB's perspective, securitization will provide real quantifiable savings to ratepayers, and this is required by the language in the bill. Securitization will not be the right tool in every instance, but as we've heard, in the right circumstances, it can save many millions of dollars and be a win for ratepayers, utility shareholders, and the power plant workers. This opportunity is here for a moment in time. The faster we act, the faster that outstanding plant balances can be securitized, and the larger that savings opportunity is. But if we wait too long, those savings will no longer be there. I want to thank Chair Long for bringing this bill forward, and CUB would be happy to work with you as you refine the details. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Next, we are hearing from John Farrell. Please introduce yourself and begin.
Hi, yes, thank you, Chair Long, Vice Chair Acomb, and members of the committee. I really appreciate the opportunity to testify about this very promising policy. My name is John Farrell. I direct the Energy Democracy Initiative at the Institute for Local Self-Reliance, where we provide energy policy analysis and technical assistance for state and local governments across the country. In May 2019, I wrote a summary of securitization policy, which is provided as a handout that provides a simplified overview and does borrow on that Sierra Club report that Jessica Tritt mentioned just a few minutes ago. But basically, it's a lot like refinancing a home mortgage, and securitization can reduce the financing costs of a power plant, even as it's used to retire highly polluting and higher cost power sources. I think this legislation does an excellent job of outlining the structure of securitization for use in Minnesota, including the detailed steps for the utility and the commission, and its direction of a portion of the savings to help with workforce transition. We have no issue with the basic structure of the proposal, but we do have three suggestions for improvement, some that have already come up in earlier discussion. The first suggestion we'd offer is to use the Worker Transition Fund or a separate portion of the refinancing savings to support the tax base of affected communities. In discussions over the retirement of Xcel Energy's Sherco coal plant, it's been clear that the implications for Becker, its school district, and the county's tax base are severe. And while the legislature acted to help Becker by overriding parts of the typical regulatory review for a new power plant, this type of action is not feasible nor really prudent management of the electricity system in most cases. As well, it may perversely increase costs and environmental harm for electric customers, as well as costing more than a straightforward package of tax-based transition funding. We really believe that a Minnesota securitization model should address tax-based implications of plant closures aided by refinancing, whether it's in Becker, Cohasset, or Prairie Island. The second suggestion is to modify Subdivision 2 to make it clear that the commission has the authority to approve less than the submitted amount for securitization, requiring utility shareholders to write off some of the expense. Most American businesses are in the position of having to write off poor business decisions from time to time, having misjudged the market. Utilities should not get a free pass. The second ILSR handout, which is a report from electric market expert Leslie Glustrom in Colorado, explains the importance of regulatory review and the ability to limit cost recovery to protect captive utility customers from ending up refinancing the poor decisions of utility management. So we think it's important that there's an option for the commission to consider that. Finally, at the end of Subdivision 1, I think it's also important that the policy leave room for non-utility assets to provide replacement power, including customer-sited and customer-owned solar, energy storage, or even aggregated demand response. Similarly, we feel that the transition funds should allow the utility to provide incentives to encourage such customer-owned systems if they are the more cost-effective approach for replacement power. We feel like with these amendments, the securitization policy can ensure a smoother economic transition for host communities of refinanced power plants, properly align risks and rewards for shareholders and customers, and ensure that the replacement power comes from the most cost-effective sources. So thank you again for the opportunity to testify and for this policy discussion.
Thank you so much. Next, we are hearing from Evan Mulholland. Please introduce yourself and begin.
Hello, Chair Long. Thank you. And hello, members of the committee, for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Evan Mulholland, and I'm testifying on behalf of MCEA, the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy. We're a nonprofit organization with almost 50 years of experience using law and science to protect Minnesota's environment. So MCEA supports this bill. We support efforts to accelerate retirement of all coal plants because burning coal is harming our climate and harming the natural world on which we all depend. Securitization like this bill is an effective tool to reduce the cost of coal plant retirements. I want to use my time to emphasize how important it is to develop and fund a plan for the coal plant workers that will be out of a job when the plant shut down. This bill provides some of this funding. The people who work at all our electric generating plants have dedicated significant portions of their working hours to keeping these complex machines running around the clock and providing the power we all need. We have an obligation to support them as we make the necessary transition to a low and no carbon future. We at MCEA encourage the committee to swiftly move this bill forward. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Next, we are hearing from Rick Evans. Mr. Evans, please introduce yourself and begin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Rick Evans with Xcel Energy. I'd just like to make a couple of observations on the bill. First of all, and of course, the committee has heard this over the last several weeks, the utilities in Minnesota are leading the charge in reducing carbon emissions across the state. In fact, it's really the only sector that's making significant progress in that. And we're doing that under the current laws and regulations and working with the Public Utilities Commission to accomplish that. Xcel Energy has already closed two of its coal plants, and the remaining four on its system are scheduled for closure within the next 10 years. At the same time, we are working with the communities and with our workers to make sure that those transitions go well, and doing all of that through the regulation of the Public Utilities Commission. That's the way that we would expect to go forward, and I would encourage the committee, as you're considering this alternative means, to take a look at what Xcel Energy has already done and what we plan to do in the future. I would add, by the way, because it often gets left off, that when our CEO made the pledge to get to a carbon-free system by 2050, he added to that with equal emphasis that our customers' bills would not be going up faster than the rate of inflation. And so Xcel Energy, in its process now of considering the plant closures that are coming toward us, we are looking at our communities, we're looking at our workers, and we're looking at our customers to make sure that this is a fair and hopefully as much as possible pain-free transition. This is important, particularly for Xcel Energy, because as many on the committee may know, we have customers in the upper Midwest in five different states. And so unless each of those five states were to pass identical securitization bills, we would have a very difficult time, possibly even an impossible time, trying to work with five public utilities commissions and to accomplish what would be accomplished under this bill. That is not a reason not to look at securitization, but it's a reason to recognize that it may be difficult to impose in a state that has a utility like us that serves in customers in five other, or in four other states besides Minnesota. And the last thing I'll mention is that, you know, the creation of a bond instrument in order to accomplish this will have an impact on the debt ratio, the capitalization of our company. That is likely to have unintended consequences in the marketplace in terms of our borrowing to make the significant investments that we intend to make going forward in the state to in this transition. So we look forward to working with the author and working with the committee and working with the legislature in how this transition is going to take place. But we would caution that, as other speakers have said today, this is not a tool for every circumstance. It's not a tool for every company. It's not a tool necessarily for every state. And so we intend to continue forward with what we think will be a very successful and good transition for our customers, our company, and the states that we operate in. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Evans. And our final public comment is from Alan Gleckner. Please introduce yourself and begin.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Alan Gleckner, Lead Director for Clean Electricity at Fresh Energy. Fresh Energy is a nearly 30-year-old Minnesota-based nonpartisan, not-for-profit organization. We work to shape and drive bold policy solutions to achieve equitable carbon neutral economies. Fresh Energy supports the securitization bill in front of you today. Fresh Energy has been working on cost-effective and reliable retirement for Minnesota coal plants for many years, and we believe that plant securitization, as presented in today's bill, is a tool that can be used to help transition our electricity system off of coal in an even more economic way. We support the effort to implement this option for Minnesota and believe this bill does so in a reasonable and fair way that prioritizes consumer protection and lowering costs for consumers. As others have said, we especially support that this bill requires setting aside funds for an energy transition account. Worker and community support through the energy transition away from coal plants and other fossil fuel generation is a critically important issue to address and should be included in a maximized use for savings generated from using securitization. So we thank the chair for bringing forward this important and innovative economic tool to help make the energy transition even more successful. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Well, that concludes the public testimony that we had folks sign up for in advance, and really appreciate members' attention and engagement on this complex discussion. I think this is the first time that I'm aware of that we've had this topic before the committee. And so I know it's a lot to digest, but appreciate everybody's engagement today on this really important tool, which I think can be, as we've heard, a win-win for communities, for customers, and for helping us manage this transition that we know is coming and that we're seeing happen already. I don't see any further discussion or business before the committee. So thank you all very much. Our meeting is adjourned, and we will be meeting next on Thursday, February 4th at 10:30 a.m.